This case involves whether either of the ministerial duty exceptions to state officer immunity applies to the actions of a state fair employee who was working with an inmate work crew in disassembling stalls at a fair barn. The exceptions to immunity are narrow, and neither applies here. Turning first to the Cords exception, which was the exception applied by the Court of Appeals majority here, there are three reasons why Cords is inapplicable on the facts of this case. The first is, and this was pointed out by Judge Fine in his dissent, is that the danger must be both severe and immediate. In Umansky, the Court of Appeals described the known danger exception as reserved for situations that are more than unsafe, where the danger is so severe and so immediate that a specific and immediate response is required. The Lodal court, this court, said that the danger must be sufficiently compelling. And in Kirsten, the court described the exception as limited to extraordinary events. Factual situations where the exception has been applied in the past include the Domino case, where there was a downed tree across the road in the night, and the dispatcher failed to send out a crew to take care of it. Linville, where the rescue squad arrived at the scene where a van was submerged in a pond and no rescue at all was attempted for 20 minutes. And Turner, where Dusty the dog, who had an incredibly long history of vicious attacks on human beings, the Milwaukee took no action to address the dog, despite the fact that the court concluded Dusty was a, quote, extreme danger. In contrast, Cords has not been applied in situations that, while dangerous, did not meet that very high danger threshold. And examples of that would include Nafke with the cheerleading stunt, and Kimps, where they were moving the heavy volleyball standard and it came apart and fell on the student's foot.
Counsel, when you talk about Nafke in this case, do you see them as similar or different? The knowing and compelling danger issue to me, just to be perfectly honest, isn't as persuasive from the plaintiff's angle. I don't know that it goes so far as every time someone gets hurt, it's a known and compelling danger after the fact. Even if it was dangerous activity, even in Nafke, you know, standing on another person's shoulders, that could be dangerous, obviously, but it is enough to rise to that level. The part that I'm having the tougher time with in this case is, unlike Nafke, where they didn't have guidelines that were adopted, where the guidelines were discretionary, where there weren't mandatory requirements, here, there are specific guidelines about how you deal with the horse stalls and what you do with the horse stalls and how you take them down. And where's the room for discretion? Tell me why you think these guidelines are discretionary or weren't adopted. Because that, to me, is, at least if you're talking to me, that's going to be a sticking point for your side of the equation.
Okay. So, Justice, you're going not to the first exception, the Cords exception, but the ministerial duty created by operation of laws, rules, and guidelines.
Correct.
And your concern is that the two-page new horse stall setup and takedown procedures, and those are in our appendix at 131 and 132, created sufficiently specific guidelines that they created a ministerial duty. If you look at what the guidelines actually tell you as to the takedown procedures, it's limited to this one section, section 6, takedown. And takedown, these five items don't cover any of the things that the plaintiff alleged were done incorrectly here. Now, when they got their case started, the argument was that Mr. McMillan had failed to properly supervise this very large crew of inmates. And he wasn't normally a supervisor. It wasn't something he normally did. There was some testimony that he didn't do a great job training them either. But none of these guidelines go to how well or how poorly he did that or how he should have gone about doing that. Then later, the argument was that He should have handled the actual takedown procedure differently. And McMillan's testimony was that these things get jammed together and you have to sometimes get up on the stall to take them apart. I mean, it's not a Swiss watch. It's big pieces of metal and they have to be, force has to be used on them in order to take them apart sometimes. The guidelines don't tell people at the state fair, what do you do when the pieces get stuck? Should you use a tool? Should you get up on the stalls? The guidelines also mention nothing about chains, which were on the, you know, the back pieces of the stalls, but not the center pieces. So there's nothing about chains at all. When should you undo them? When should you not undo them? So this is a person who's faced with, you know, and he had done this task many times, and he said, you know, on different occasions, I have to do it differently in order to get the stalls down. Now, after the incident, it seems the record suggests that the state fair staff came up with much more specific guidelines. But those, and I think there's no dispute that those were not in place at the time and would not have been something that McMillan was supposed to use in how he was directed to do his tasks.
So if I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. You're saying these guidelines, while they exist, don't speak to when the stalls are stuck together, and therefore, because they don't address that possibility, they really are of no assistance here?
Well, they don't discuss a number of things. They don't discuss how to work with volunteers, or probably it's not fair to describe the inmates as volunteers, but people who show up to work with you. They don't discuss how to deal with stalls that become stuck together. They don't discuss, if you're dealing with a stall that has chains, when should you chain it or unchain it? So, and I think a good analogy to this is the Yao case, where there were some, you know, the plaintiff was arguing, well, there are, you know, some regulations in place that, you know, provide some guidance about how to deal with liquid nitrogen. And the court said, the standards say nothing about access to or control of a liquid nitrogen tank, how or how often determine whether the liquid nitrogen level is sufficient, how to replenish the liquid nitrogen when it becomes necessary to do so, or how to properly open and refasten the tank lid. So you see there an expectation that the rule, that the state law or policy has to go specifically to the tasks which are alleged to have been performed incorrectly. They don't, you know, it's not enough that there's some rule or some guideline out there that vaguely or goes to the procedure at hand. It has to specifically speak to the acts of the person. And to me, the ministerial duty exception is similar to the idea of mandamus, where you can just direct the public officer to do the thing. I mean, it's right there in the law, and you have to add up the election results or whatever the task is, but it has to be directly in the law.
So was someone holding up the piece that was being taken down?
And then I want to get back to my. I don't know that he directed, if he directed anyone to hold up the piece that he was taking down.
I don't want to take all your time. Thank you.
I ask you some questions about Mr. Priest. He was an inmate?
That's right.
Who deployed him to State Fair Park?
My understanding is that the Milwaukee County Jail brought him over. He was not in a state prison. He was in the Milwaukee County Jail, and he came over with a Milwaukee County Jail officer, Mr. Stein, I believe.
Was he being paid for his work?
That's not in the record, so I have no idea.
Uber? It was he on Stein. Uber?
I'm
was
sorry.
He out? Was he on Huber?
I think he was on Huber, actually. You're right, Your Honor.
I don't know if I'm right. I asked a question.
Yeah, there is some testimony that I'm just not sure whether it was the testimony of Pries or of his fellow inmate, Mr. Galvin, but one of them testifies they're on Huber.
Was he entitled to any workers' compensation?
I don't know whether he was. His medical costs, I would assume he was not. But that's my assumption. His medical costs were paid by the county.
But his foot was broken?
That's correct.
And he was probably unable to use it for a while, and there was pain and suffering and all that?
Right, and the judgment in this case reflects some pain and suffering damages. Because as the court's aware, this case was tried, and there was a judgment entered.
Did he have any continuing disability afterward?
I think his testimony is that, you know, he's pretty much fine now. You know, occasionally it hurts a little, but he's pretty much healed.
Well, should he be compensated for his injury?
The question is, in what context does that should arise? Public officer immunity reflects a balance between trying to offer programs at an affordable cost that the public wants and finding redress for people who may be injured while participating in them.
Did this individual contribute to his injury some way? Would you try to say, well, he's really partially at fault here?
Arguably, the testimony was that he and other inmates had taken the chains off the walls, and obviously, as a factual matter, they had contributed, but I don't think that's part of the trial court's findings.
Well, is there any question in your mind that there was negligence here on the part of Mr. McMillan?
Well, I don't know about my mind personally, but for purposes of this appeal, we're accepting the trial court's finding of negligence. So I think we can all just accept that Mr. McMillan was negligent. Bless you.
Well, isn't the real issue in this case, in the face of really clear negligence on the part of Mr. McMillan and real injury on the part of Mr. Priest, why on earth shouldn't there be compensation? I mean, why wasn't this settled?
I'm sorry, I missed your last.
Why wasn't this settled?
Why wasn't it settled? I don't know. I wasn't trial counsel.
Well, you have a defense here. You're not caving in on this case, are you?
No. I mean, but
probably
not at all.
Governmental immunity. Right?
That's right.
I mean, that's the real defense to the case, which is why you're here.
Right. I mean, parties settle cases all the time when there are very legitimate defenses for reasons other than whether they ultimately will win a trial or in the Supreme Court.
So the state is not willing to pay up when a person is injured and a state employee is negligent. That's your position, because you have a defense of immunity.
Well, there are four exceptions to.
Well, you're coming into an exception, but that's the state's position. They're not going to pay for an employee's negligence. If someone is injured, right? Because you fall under an exception.
That's the general rule, right? And as Justice Prosser alluded to, if the person injured is a fellow employee, obviously there's workers' comp, and, you know, there are lots of situations where the medical care is picked up, as it was here, by Medicaid or some other government program.
So as Mr. Priest's status at the time of the event, the record seems to indicate that he was a member of a work team assigned to leave the jail for a certain period of time under the supervision of a jail officer to be returned after the work was done. Does that accord with your recollection of the record?
Yes.
The second thing I'd like to do is direct your attention back to the prescribed method for the takedown of the horse stalls as set forward in the record exhibit 8, your appendix, page 132. And this is actually a follow-up to Justice Eagler's questions, because I am very curious about this. When we talk about discretion seems to imply at least a modicum of reflection. Is there anything in the record to indicate that Mr. McMillan exercised any kind of reflection or thought about what he was about to do?
Well, first of all, I'd like to challenge that premise a bit, because I don't think discretionary immunity looks at whether the public officer actually made a contemplative discretionary, had this discretionary moment. It goes to whether the tasks presented that presented at the time involved the exercise of discretion.
But
so I see as an
aren't we really talking about the room for the exercise of judgment? It seems to me that the underlying philosophy behind this, either in if we're talking about a court's known and present danger exception, or if we're talking about the track that was applied in Noffke, or at least presented in Noffke, which is because of the strictures and the order and the prescribed methods, there's simply no room for judgment. It's simply a ministerial task. It seems to me the opposite of ministerial is an exercise of judgment, which is what happens when someone exercises discretion.
Right. And in fact, Mr. McMillan was exercising discretion in the sense that he decided to let the crews work in two separate groups. He decided to let one crew work, you know, on its own with no supervision. He decided about the amount of training or guidance he was going to get them, give them before
but
they started.
Nothing about those things was in contravention to the prescribed method listed at number six, takedown.
No.
And if we go to 6A, and this is what Justice Eagler had asked you about, always have someone holding up the piece that you are taking down. So when he climbed up, as I understand, he had to climb up, and he was going to, for lack of a better phrase, kick the stuck stall. He did, in fact, kick it.
In my understanding, and I wasn't at trial, so I didn't get to see the witness motions, but my understanding was more of an arm motion, but he was kind of jerking it with his arms. But.
So there was no one, if there was no one holding the piece that he was attempting to take down, isn't that in contravention to the very specific prescription that's in the guidelines?
Right, and I'm not sure how much that was developed at trial.
Well, as to that's A, as to B, C, D, and E, those seem B, take out the top pins on the top of the stall piece and then lift the stall piece off the bottom pins. Those pins had been removed, I believe. That's my recollection of the record. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding.
C would not be applicable. This wasn't a case about stacking or the lack of stacking. And storage in D would not be applicable. And E, there's no vice. So it really comes down to, is there room for Mr. McMillan to have exercised his judgment or discretion when he was loosening the stuck stall?
Right. I mean, basically what you're saying is until that moment, he definitely was exercising his discretion how he handled the situation. And it was just a question of, at the point at which he's faced with these stuck stalls, how should he deal with that?
But then there's an interesting interplay with 6A. If he wasn't following 6A, that seems to be a violation of the prescribed method.
Right, and I just don't know how clear the trial testimony was on that issue. It was not a focus of trial, so.
Thank you.
Ms. Gibson, I've got a couple of questions. As I listened to you, at least when you started out here, you seemed to be talking strictly about cords and about a knowing and compelling danger. Now, when I read the Court of Appeals majority decision, they seem to be talking not only about cords, but also about a ministerial duty. And they specifically seem to say that there is a violation here also of a ministerial duty. Am I misreading, do you think, the Court of Appeals decision?
I think you are, Your Honor. And maybe the confusion derives from the fact that since Lodal, the court's exception has been characterized as a variant of a ministerial duty exception. So the fact that they're using the word ministerial duty and courts in the same section
look at paragraph 25 of the Court of Appeals decision, okay? Where it says, furthermore, we agree with Preece that a ministerial duty arose when McMillan saw that the chains had been removed. Then they go on to say the removal of the chains had created a dangerous situation. So aren't they, if you want to separate these into two different approaches to exception to immunity, aren't they riding both horses, if you will?
No, I don't think so, because if you look at the language in the first sentence carefully, the ministerial duty is created by the situation, and that's what Cords talks about, right? You're faced with a certain situation. Now, we believe a situation far more dangerous than this, but it's a situational duty that's created, whereas the sort of we'll call it the traditional ministerial duty exception is created by a statute, rule, or policy. It's always there. It's there. You know, you go to work in the morning, and it's sitting there waiting for you.
Well, can you really separate those out? Cords actually, and I agree with you, Cords mixes the two, okay? But later on, our jurisprudence seemed to separate those out into two different duties. As I read the opposing brief, it was my understanding that they felt, they being the counsel for the injured party here, that both exceptions applied if you separate them out. Both the knowing and compelling danger exception of Cords and the ministerial duty exception. Now, you take issue with that?
No, I think in theory, obviously not in this case, but in theory it is possible that the facts of a case would present both. And an example of that is Turner, I think, where the court said both applies. There was a city ordinance that required the destruction of dogs who presented a certain danger risk, which Dusty obviously did, and then also Dusty's dangerousness required. So you could have both in the right case. But I don't think the Court of Appeals did that in this case. If you look at paragraph 14, the court says, at issue is the applicability of two exceptions to discretionary act immunity, the ministerial duty exception and the known danger exception. We conclude that the known danger exception to discretionary act immunity applies. So that's all they get. I think that's a nice, clear statement of all they're trying to accomplish. I don't think they were trying to get at the classic ministerial duty exception at all.
Counsel, paragraph 1 indicates that the Court of Appeals is affirming the judgment on the basis of the known danger exception, and then it continues, we do not consider whether the ministerial duty exception also applies. Cases should be decided on the narrowest possible grounds, and then they cite. So I think
thank you, Your Honor. I thought that was in there somewhere.
We're consistent, for example, with NAFGI. NAFGI talks about the ministerial duty imposed by law. That would be the kind of ministerial duty described with respect to the spirit rules in that case and whether they followed the spirit rules. If the spirit rules were mandatory and they didn't follow them, they didn't leave room for discretion, that could be a way under immunity because they didn't follow that ministerial duty as to a statute, a rule, something like that. Another ministerial duty imposed is it arises out of a known and compelling danger. And if you have that known and compelling danger, like in Cords, that can get under the immunity protections and create a duty as an exception to immunity. They're both ministerial duties, but they're different. There are two ways to undermine or get under immunity. Well, there are more than two, but what we're talking about here and what they were talking about, for example, in NAPI, there are two ways that ministerial duty. So to say known and compelling danger isn't a ministerial duty, I think is not exactly correct.
No.
It is one type, and then there's another type. So here we have a ministerial duty because of the rules that are in Appendix 132, and a possible ministerial duty because of a known and compelling danger, either of which, if satisfied, would undercut the immunity that is at issue here, as I see the law.
No, I completely agree with you. And to the extent I was challenging this court's decision in Lodal that says the court's exception is a type of ministerial duty exception, I'm not at all.
Okay. So I make sure.
I was just addressing Justice Crook's question as to whether the Court of Appeals was using both exceptions here or just one. And Justice Bradley helped me out and found the very explicit paragraph where they say, no, we're just dealing with the court's exception.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Merrick Domnitz, representing Michael Preece.
Good morning, Justices. I am Merrick R. Domnitz, and along with my son, Noah Domnitz, we represent Michael Preece in this matter. Privilege and an honor to appear before the court again. My responsibility before this court today is to represent Michael Preece in his prosecution of his claim against a state employee whose negligence caused Mr. Preece serious physical injury. But the sirens of change seek to lure me from my dedicated task. In fulfillment of my primary responsibility, let me counter the strained argument of my opponent, an argument which would have this court find liability if the stall section had hit Michael Preece in the head or killed or maimed him, but not when he was fortunate enough to only have his foot smashed. Let me counter that position by reviewing for the court the findings of the trial court in this court trial, findings which, according to the holdings of this Supreme Court, are to be upheld unless they are clearly erroneous. Here are the findings of fact by the trial court. Number one, the only defendant in this case is a state employee, McMillan. Number two, McMillan admitted that he knew that removing the chains before taking down a stall was improper. Number three, McMillan's actions violated the written instructions for the disassembly of the stalls. Number four, McMillan was aware the stalls were stuck, aware that the chains were undone, and aware that the inmates were standing next to the stalls. Number five, McMillan knew of the clear standard of care, the written instructions, knew the chains should be in place before trying to remove a stall, but he, quote, got on top of a stall and began to shake it, end quote, from the trial court. And number six, the trial court found that the greater weight of the credible evidence to a reasonable certainty is that McMillan was jumping on the stalls to loosen them before the stalls toppled and injured the plaintiff. There can be no real dispute that these facts, found by the trial court as the finder of fact and the source of the law, indicate liability on the part of McMillan within the scope of his employment. As this court is aware, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals have found that liability attaches to the acts of McMillan, but purportedly on different grounds. The trial court determined that the ministerial duty exception to governmental immunity applied and that the known present danger exception did not. The Court of Appeals, on the other hand, determined that the known present danger exception applied, but as Justice Bradley has pointed out, did not reach the issue of the ministerial duty exception. They didn't address it at all. In light of the fact that less than a year before this court accepted the current case for consideration, the court issued its decision in the Umansky case, which holding would seem to be controlling precedent for our case, I sense there may be more at work here than the narrow consideration of my client's clear-cut case, supported as it is by both a trial court decision and a court of appeals decision. And I welcome the broader issue consideration by this court.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to follow up with Justice Prosser's, one of his areas of inquiry. And I'm looking at the summons and the complaint here and also the answer. The complaint indicates that the plaintiff is an employee of the state park entity. And the answer to that averment, which is number five in the complaint, is that the answer admits that he was in the scope of his employment for the Wisconsin State Fair Park. So why isn't this case precluded as an action against the employer?
Because he really wasn't a state employee at all, Your Honor. He was an inmate at the House of Correction as a result of the Milwaukee County Jail. Mm-hmm. He was brought to the state fair at the request of the state authorities in order to do some work for them. And he was not on Huber. He was part of a work detail, as Justice Gableman pointed out, that was brought to the state fair to do the work of the state under his sentence into the Milwaukee County Jail.
The complaint, as I said, in paragraph 5, avers that... So he wasn't an employee for the state park fair, and he wasn't a loaned employee either.
No, ma'am.
Because we have those cases that we deal with, of course, if you go to Manpower or some temporary work agency and you're assigned to work someplace, that if you're injured at the assigned place, you cannot bring a lawsuit against the place where you were assigned in that employee.
One of the many constant banes of my existence, Justice Bradley. I'm well aware of that doctrine, and it doesn't fit these facts.
So he didn't get workers' comp?
He didn't. The caption doesn't reflect the notice in my file anywhere reflect the presence of any workers' compensation consideration. There have been no 10229 documents prepared after the judgment was entered. I see no indication whatsoever that there's any involvement of a workers' compensation carrier.
Another thing that's curious to me is that it doesn't appear that there was any claim by the state of contributory negligence. As I read their answer, they answered and they asserted immunity. And you know, I would normally expect some kind of a boilerplate averment of contributory negligence. And of course, the court didn't have any comparison of negligence. So this contributory negligence was never an issue in this case, I take it.
Correct, Justice.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I'd like to talk about Exhibit 8, the appendix, page 132, the prescribed method for takedown. Just as I asked Ms. Gibson about the prescribed method for taking the horse stalls down, doesn't there appear to be a particular silence there in regard to what happens or what is supposed to happen if one of those pieces of the horse stall are stuck? If one of the sections is stuck, what is the worker supposed to do? And the second part of my question would be, doesn't that imply that there's some kind of room for the exercise of discretion if that happens?
I would beg to differ respectfully, Your Honor. The reason is because no set of instructions made for a task such as the one that is at issue in this case could reasonably be expected to address every conceivable possible situation that could arise. There certainly are within our law innumerable examples of statutes, for example, that clearly lay out clear ministerial duties. I mean, when a state employee operates his car, a state car, within the scope of his employment, and is traveling down the road, and the issue is whether or not that person has violated the reckless driving statute. If you look to the reckless driving statute, it doesn't say that you shouldn't drive down the road with your eyes closed, because you can't possibly bring under the auspices of any given set of rules every conceivable situation in which they could be violated. The important thing, I think, for our consideration, for our purposes here today, is that the trial court findings, again, which are to be given great deference by this court, indicated that not only Mr. McMillan, but the other people from the state and the jail all testified that they knew that the chains were not to be removed from these stall sections.
And I noticed your emphasis on the trial court's factual findings, you know, for good reason, in your briefs. And that goes to the factual questions, but it seems to me the legal question that we're presented with runs to whether this is a ministerial duty or whether there was room for discretion. And I guess, just as I was focusing in on this with Ms. Gibson, that section 6, number 6, the takedown method, seems to be Just as in Nofke, there was the spirit rules. Just in Umansky, there were various federal regulations that prescribed whether or not the gate had to be up on the stand. It seems to me that the argument that this was a ministerial duty is centered or based upon the existence of Exhibit 8, that there is a prescribed takedown method. Now, I know there was testimony at the court trial in regard to what the common practice was and what the understanding was about the chains. But if we look at the prescribed method, that is the method, the vehicle by which it seems to me your client has to say, look, this was a ministerial duty. There was no room for the exercise of discretion. It seems to be silent. Now we have the interesting part of it that A was not followed. But I'm trying to get a better understanding of the interplay between the lack of the following of 6A and the violation of the establishment, rather, of the ministerial duty and then the violation of that duty.
I would have a twofold response, Your Honor. The first is that clearly 6A was violated. There was nobody holding the piece that fell on my client. So that's a clear violation of subparagraph 6A of the dissembly rules. So to the extent that the court would like to define the existence of a ministerial duty solely to some sort of written instruction, some statute in Umansky, some OSHA regulation, then there is a basis, therefore, that was clearly violated. I think the more reasoned approach to this, with all due respect, Your Honor, is to say that the definition of a known standard of care is not necessarily tied directly to something that's written somewhere in black and white. There are situations in life, and we all deal with them on a daily basis, where just plain old common sense indicates that everybody involved in the activity knows that this is what's done or what should not be done.
Well, I agree with you to the extent that runs to the cords, known and present danger. Exception, but it seems to me if we're talking about the exception based on the written findings or the written prescription, it seems to me that there's a little tighter. It seems to me your argument would be more of a stronger argument, a bolstering of a known and present danger.
If, Your Honor, there was some dispute, for example, during the testimony at the trial, or some indication by the trial court that it was a matter of controversy, that these stalls were not to be disassembled until the chains, without the chains in place to make sure that they didn't fall, then there might be a point to be made there. But it was the consistent testimony by everybody at the trial that the number one safety procedure involved here is that as long as you kept those chains attached to those stalls, this exact type of accident would logically be prevented. And he violated that known standard of care.
And that certainly raises the question why that's not on Exhibit 8.
Poor draftsmanship, Your Honor. I would also point out this, and by the way, not drafts.
You
not
didn't
draftsmanship
draft it.
By my client, yes. I would also point out this, Your Honor. You'll recall that in Justice Prosser's very well-reasoned and scholarly concurrence in Umansky, he pointed out a quote from Professor Prosser. Okay, and in there, Professor Prosser said, look, every ministerial duty is going to have some element of discretion involved, even if it's no more than the driving of a nail. And that's the truth of the matter. If we look at these things in a logical sense, in the sense of what goes on in the real world, there's always an argument that can be made that some sort of discretion is involved in almost all human activity. The examples of the discretion that were afforded to Mr. McMillan in this case that were cited by my worthy opponent are quite frankly examples of how desperate people can be when they look for things. He could have given more instruction to the inmates. He could have told them to stand farther away from the stands. Well, those are just the comments of a party, quite frankly, that's grasping for straws to bring into this discussion some element of discretion in what clearly is a well-defined ministerial duty on how to do this. It's a real simple issue.
Counselor, I think that there are two different things, at least in my analysis of what goes on here. The first is this takedown, these procedures, five of them, sufficient in and of themselves to create a ministerial duty in the disassembly of the stalls. That's one thing. If it is not, is there a clear and present danger that should have been recognized due to the removal of the chains during the takedown process? And I'd like you to focus on them separately because it helps me a little bit in my understanding of the case. And as I look at the takedown procedures, I'd like you to let me know why you... I don't think they're sufficient, frankly. I don't think they're sufficient in and of themselves to remove all discretion on how you take down these stalls. And I'd like you just to focus on those and tell me why they are sufficient to create a ministerial duty in the takedown of these stalls.
Because, yes, Your Honor. Because in Section 6A, it says always, no discretion, always have someone hold up the piece that you are taking down, not followed. If that would have been followed, the stall piece doesn't fall, my client doesn't get injured. When you have a set of disassembly instructions that start out with a thing that says always have someone building up, that creates the ministerial duty to have somebody holding the piece before you try to take it down. In addition to that, a part of the court's consideration, I believe, according to the rules, has to be the findings of the trial court. The trial court said that the...
Just let me hold you up there. Whether there's a ministerial duty or not, it's a question of law. Okay, so I give you your findings. I'm not trying to get under them. I just want to focus on the four squares of the procedures, and I think you've done a good job with that. Now, let's forget the procedures, and I want to look at the other side of whether there is a clear and present danger. And if I understand your argument, you're saying they created the clear and present danger by proceeding with the chains off, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would add to that mechanism where you think a clear and present danger was presented?
Yeah, I always do that, too. I always get the title of the movie mixed up with the legal standard. It's not clear and present danger. It's known
no.
present danger.
Yeah,
but
we are talking about
it. It was a very good
thing.
Movie and worthy of mention in this argument. Your Honor, I believe that there was a known and present danger, and the elements of that consideration really seem to be the very words that are used in it. Number one, was it a known danger?
Yeah, and I understand they never fell over on anybody before.
I have no proof that there was prior incidents like this, okay?
Okay.
I don't remember there being any proof in courts, by the way, that anybody had fallen into the gorge before either. Okay?
All right.
Number two, was it a present danger? Well, clearly... If you didn't have the chains in place at any point in time that one of these stalls was removed, it would have, as it did in this case, instantly created a danger to all of the inmates and all of the supervisors present that one of these sections, each of which, by the way, was a 200-pound steel section of a stall, could have fallen on any one of those people, could have hit them not in the foot, as my client was, quote-unquote, lucky enough to have happened to him, but could have struck them in the head, could have struck them from behind if their back was turned. It was a known and present danger because proceeding in the absence of the safety chains being attached created an immediate danger to everybody that was in the range of the stall sections. And the testimony was that Mr. McMillan knew that the inmates were all within the fall pattern of the stall section. So I think it absolutely does qualify under the known and present danger. I think it raises an interesting question, because if we listen to all of the questions that have been asked by the justices today, there is this constant search for how do these two concepts play together? What is it? And I think that controversy, that search, is exactly what goes on in the trial bar and at the trial court level ever since these decisions that Justice Prosser called to task in his concurrence have sort of muddied the waters on what's going on here. Justice Prosser said in his concurrence that there may have been a time at which sovereign immunity, governmental immunity, made sense, but that in the following situations, it doesn't make sense anymore. Number one, where sovereign immunity has been abrogated, and it has been in Wisconsin ever since the Hollitz decision in 1962. Number two, where governmental entities have accepted their respondeat superior relationship with their employees, and they have by statute in Wisconsin. And number three, it makes no sense, and I want to make sure I get Justice Prosser's words exactly right, when public immunity is used to evade liability for employees' obvious breach of a known standard of care. And that's really the bigger issue that's in front of this court today. And that is your decision going to continue this situation where we know that state actors act negligently, where we know that within the scope of their employment they do something or omit some act that clearly is a substantial factor in bringing about harm to a citizen of the state of Wisconsin, in light of the fact that they have no individual responsibility, no individual financial responsibility for the payment of that judgment? Are we going to continue to allow them to duck under the liability by having this immunity, which in Justice Prosser's words may have been valuable and necessary at some point, but is currently unfair and absurd?
Well, if we take that view, how many cases do you think we have to overrule?
Roughly. I think you have
I would say
3 to 5. 3 to 5. I think there's clearly Lister, Leifer, and Kimps that would need to be overruled. Okay.
Woods, too, because it makes an exception. It doesn't adopt as a rule what you're proposing. So Cords would have to go, and a multitude of other cases, including the case that where the guidance counselor gave the wrong advice to the player.
Lister.
And would you read out the ministerial doctrine? Because the statute says quasi-judicial, doesn't it, or quasi-legislative rather than ministerial?
I think there are two ways that the court could go, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. One is the way that is suggested in the amicus brief, and that is to simply say that, and I've been knocked off my tracker enough that I can't find the quote in my prepared remarks, but the one that's suggested in there where they basically say that if there's the violation of a known standard of care, then that creates a ministerial duty, then liability will attach and immunity will not be the case. The other way to do it, Your Honor, is I think to take a look at the fact that when the justices are having difficulty sorting out the interplay between these two concepts, I think the reason for that is because they are, in fact, very much associated concepts. If we look at these in the traditional context of tort law, they really amount to no more than a restatement of the law of foreseeability, okay? In this case, and in Cords, for example.
Let me just summarize your argument, see if you agree with my summary. The general rules of negligence should apply to government.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
Period. It's not quasi-judicial. It's not quasi-legislative. General rules of negligence apply to government.
No question about the fact that state actors who are involved in legislative, judicial, or quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial activities clearly deserve the protection of governmental immunity. Outside of that, when we're talking about what would otherwise be the common law negligence of a person who just happens to be a state employee, there, now that the states have accepted their respondeat superior relationship with their employees, so there's no individual financial exposure, there's no reason to have the immunity.
Well, you say the state has accepted. I think the Attorney General would argue the state has accepted the long-standing interpretation of the statute to say that all negligence, the state's not liable for all negligence, that certain kinds of acts of negligence will fall into quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative.
And then I guess it comes down to a matter of the definition of those terms, Your Honor. I mean, that's all, it always boils down to that. What I know is that after Hollitz, the legislature enacted statutes, 893-80, 893-82, in which they clearly had the choice to go back to the rules of immunity, and they chose with regard to municipalities, counties, and the state to not return to the issue of immunity, but rather to outline certain procedures that need to be followed in order to be able to sue individuals that are employed by the state or employed by a municipality.
Mr. Donowitz, let me interrupt you at this point because I want to be clear on this. Do you lose if we don't go back to Hollitz?
No, I don't think so. I think my case qualifies under the existing state of the law as it comes out of the Umansky case.
So you'd be satisfied, I take it, if this court were to write either known and present danger or ministerial duty?
I'm happy when my clients prevail, Your Honor, yes.
Doesn't surprise me.
So that you're arguing a much broader concept. You can win on the narrow one. You want the big issue, too.
I am, Your Honor, because as I said early in my comments, I can't help but notice that less than a year after Umansky was decided, this court voted to take this case and hear it. And I just, maybe it's 35 years of experience that tells me there's something else at play here. I'm really not trying to just pander to Justice Prosser, but he was the author of the concurrence. And I would be saying the same thing if any of the others of you had authored that concurrence, because it's the logic that I find attractive, even though I do find Justice Prosser to be attractive as an individual. But it's the logic that really draws me to the decision. Okay?
Is there some pandering, do you think?
Is there some
pandering? I have to ask you this. As the author of the majority opinion in Umansky, didn't you like that?
I did, Your Honor, and that was what we call a lock for you, Your Honor. It was well played, sir.
I want to address a little bit about Umansky and the whole ministerial duty. Now, in Umansky, we had a ministerial duty. There was a duty under 29 CFR 1910.23C1. And if I recall, that duty was awfully darn specific. That is, it described that you had to have a 4-foot wall on this platform. And then it also described what the sidings, how they had to interplay with the 4-foot wall. Here it is. You had to have an intermediate rail and post and shall have a vertical height of 42 inches nominal from upper surface of top rail to floor, platform, runaway, or ramp level. The top rail shall be smooth surface throughout the length of the railing. The intermediate rail shall be approximately halfway between, etc. So when I think of our law thus far, it has to be so certain in time, mode, and occasion as to remove discretion. I see Umansky as being pretty detailed. I'm not sure I see 6A, always have someone holding up the piece that you are taking down, as detailed. And I have two questions. The second is, in looking at the findings that you refer to by the trial court, I do not recall that he made any finding with regard to whether or not when the defendant was doing whatever he was doing, that there was or was not someone holding up the peace at that time.
Let me respond to those in serial fashion. The first thing is, Your Honor, for this court to hold that these disassembly instructions were not up to the Umansky standard because of that was an OSHA standard that had been incorporated into our administrative code, okay? To say that my client should be denied this judgment because the state did an incomplete and poor job of drafting their instructions to their employees would be to deny my client his rightful remedy on the basis of a sloppy draftsmanship job by the state. I mean, Michael Priest was not consulted on how specific the instructions could be. What I do know is that the defendant McMillan himself said that these were instructions that needed to be followed every time without deviation, and that he knew that the safety chains were the real safety net here and shouldn't be done. So that's what I know about the record.
With regard to the findings, when I read them, I saw findings that he being the defendant, was on top of the rail. I saw findings that there weren't any chains, but I might be missing something, but I didn't see any finding with regard to whether or not someone was holding it while this was going on.
You're correct, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because all of the testimony at the trial was focused on the chains.
Yes.
Everybody agreed that that was the real thing. Instead of having somebody, remember that a number of these things fell, the description in the record is that they fell like dominoes, okay? And my client was not injured by the specific one that this guy was necessarily jumping on. He was injured by one of the stalls that fell that was in close proximity to where Mr. McMillan was jumping. And the fact of the matter is that because the trial testimony was focused on the lack of the use of the chains, which were acknowledged by everybody to be the known manner in which this danger was to be eliminated, the court did not end up making a finding about whether or not, specifically about whether or not 6A was violated.
And so we don't know whether or not always have someone holding up the piece that you are taking down was or was not violated at the time.
I can't point to something in the record, but I believe that the testimony was that nobody was holding any of them, that McMillan just jumped up and just started shaking these things and knowing that everybody was around there, but there was no testimony that anybody was holding up any of them.
Yeah, and there was certainly no finding about that.
Yes, ma'am. I see that my red light is on. I'd be happy to answer any other questions if the court would grant me the time.
Court grants you the time, Justice Cross.
You used an example a little bit earlier about a state employee driving a car and maybe driving recklessly.
Yes, sir.
If the state employee was just driving negligently, would there be compensation to an injured party?
Well, I think there would, and clearly driving a car always has elements of discretion in it, but on the other hand, we have rules of the road that create clearly ministerial duties. I mean, if a state employee is speeding, he's violated a known standard of care. We have a speeding statute. If he's driving recklessly or at an imprudent speed, he's violating a ministerial duty because we have a statute that says you're not to drive your car in an imprudent manner given the circumstances that surround it. And yet all of us know that in driving a car, a driver, state employee or not, is faced with innumerable discretionary decisions to make with regard to this. Goes back to Professor Prosser's statement that even in the face of clear ministerial duties, there are always going to be elements that one could identify as being discretionary, even if it's no more than driving a nail into a piece of wood.
I wonder if driving a car is a good example, because isn't there a special exception for negligence on the state employee for driving?
Right.
I mean, the state takes liability there, I believe.
Yes, up to a limit.
Right.
I certainly don't want to base my client's fate in this case on my pulling the example of driving a car out of the air, Your Honor.
Well, it seems to me there might be a statute, exactly as the chief indicates there. But if the goal is to make the state responsible for ordinary negligence by its employees, this might not be the case to do that. But my own view is that if we were to side with you on either of the two exceptions that are at issue here, those are not exactly, these facts do not present exactly classic examples of either one of those ministerial exceptions. And yet if we don't find that there is no immunity here, it is just total injustice.
Well, I certainly would agree that it's an injustice, Your Honor, and I would respectfully request that this case provides a vehicle for the court to give careful consideration to the real interplay between these two concepts. They really are interrelated, okay? I think that again, with all due respect, what has happened to the court, and I'm not talking about these specific seven justices, but the court in generic terms, is that we have abandoned the singular holding of Hollett's. and that is that from this point forward, 1962, liability is to be the rule and immunity is to be the exception. And when you look at these things through the eyes of immunity, you get a whole set of questions that you want to ask. But when you look at them through the traditional rules of law that apply to liability being the rule, I think clarity is visited upon all of these subjects. And I think, Your Honor, that we end up with your statement in the Umansky concurrence, and that is that accountability is the price of justice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gibson.
I just want to get back to one point on cords, and then we can go back to the other ministerial duty exception. The cases in which the cords exception have been applied are cases that involved an acute public safety crisis, essentially, and where public officers whose specific job it was to deal with those safety issues failed to do anything at all. And so you have this tremendously dangerous situation that the government had undertaken to make safe in the first place. It wasn't just a situational danger like you might have if you're repairing a car or building a building or working with any kind of large equipment and potentially dangerous things arise. And I think that the dissent in the Court of Appeals got this exactly right, which is that, you know, when we look back in hindsight, to find negligence, we have to find that the situation was unreasonably dangerous. So if we use the standard used by the Court of Appeals in this case, essentially the court's exception swallows the rule of immunity. And
Ms. Gibson,
as reflected,
I've got to ask you, since you listened to your opposing counsel's argument, what's the state's position? Should we go back to Hollitz? Should we go back to the idea that liability is the general holding and immunity is the exception?
No, Your Honor, and I won't quarrel with what the strengths and weaknesses of Hollitz originally were, but the fact is that was 1962, and it's now been almost 50 years since then. In the interim, the court has developed a long line of cases and developed a stable body of law applying these immunity doctrines, and I think they're actually fairly coherent. The legislature, which has again and again actually tried to limit state officer immunity and limit the taxpayers' responsibility to pay for these kinds of costs, has also relied on this very stable, long-term body of case law. One of the nice things about working on a case in this area is there's so many cases, and like sometimes when we're struggling with just a single case, we've really got a nice basket full of cases.
How many cases do you think would have to be overruled if we said negligence of a state employee makes the state liable?
Well, and I didn't separate out which of the cases we cited in the brief were municipal officers versus state officers, but all of the ones that are state officers.
Every single one.
Yes. And public officer immunity is a little bit like the Fourth Amendment. You know, when you're there and you're actually having to apply it, it's painful because you have someone, you know, in that situation who you might say is guilty. But in a larger scale, in a larger policy, its wisdom has been borne out for hundreds of years. And when you think about, in theory, we've got a DNR person out there inspecting dams, for example. Do we want them to have some discretionary freedom to go out and inspect this dam and do the best job they can, even though at the end of the day, the people who benefit most from the dam inspection, the people who live right around the dam, might also be those who bear the burden if the dam inspection goes awry. And this kind of balancing of burdens and benefits has to be seen in the big picture and not just at the moment at which you have a single person get injured and you say, well, we would like to give some pain and suffering damages for this person's foot. And Mr. Preece may not see himself that much as a beneficiary of this, but in general, the public has a policy of promoting work release programs and thinks it's a good idea, thinks it's good for prisoners and the public. Maybe from a risk management perspective, it's a little dangerous. These guys weren't trained. Maybe it's not something that the free market would have undertaken. But the government did undertake it. And this public has asked that we provide these benefits but also limit the cost of them. So I think this certainly is not the occasion on which to undo those long-established and, I think, working doctrines.
If Mr. Domnitz indicated that Mr. Priest could have been hit on the head or the back of the head, could conceivably have been hit in the face, suppose he had lost eyesight in both eyes, would you just say, well, that's the balance, that's the price we have to pay for this?
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, the legal system doesn't redress every wrong. We have statutes of limitation, and if someone shows up beyond that, we say we're sorry. We have service rules, and if you can't get the defendant served within 90 days, we say sorry. There are many, many situations in which we have people who are injured by somebody else, and there's no, the judicial system doesn't fix that situation for them. And so I think to say, well, we have an injury, and thus we have to find recourse for it, doesn't accord with the way we have the rest of our legal system set up.
But this is clear negligence.
Yes, well, even when there's clear negligence, right, we have damage caps, even when there's clear negligence. We have statutes of limitations, even when there's clear negligence. Even when there's an intentional intentional tort. Of course, that doesn't apply to the immunity question, but even when the tortfeasor conduct is really egregious, we still don't always provide recourse at the end of the day. It's a system that has to take into account a lot of different competing interests.
So there isn't a remedy for every wrong, despite the Wisconsin Constitution.
No, there's not, Your Honor.
Thank you both to Attorney Gibson and Attorney Domnitz for yet another argument in a long series of cases relating to government immunity. And that ends our hearing on 08 AP89, Michael Priest versus Raymond Miller. Thank you very much. The court will take a short recess because the Monticello High School students will be entering. We're in recess, just a few minutes.